Aloha and welcome to this Tuesday edition of The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. The Hawaii State Legislature thrives on displays of unity, and with a single-party dominance unlike any state in the country, you would think it could speak with one voice. But as last week's special session on rail demonstrated, the Democratic Party-dominated state legislature has deep internal divisions, shifting alliances, and a growing gulf between the interests of Oahu and the neighbor islands. You can't understand capital machinations without looking at its political factions. And Jim Shawn, former lawmaker and longtime legislative observer, is with us in our studio to sort them out. Hi, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
Aloha.
When you're on the rail at the Capitol in the middle of a hearing.
On the rail? Is that a pun?
It could be. But, you know, people stand on the rail after a hearing at the Capitol and talk informally about alliances and where the bodies are buried. And you frequently hear discussion of factions, to which I'm not sure the public is that aware of. But most people who work in the Capitol can tell you at any given time who's in what faction. Is that true?
That's true. And the factions are also vehicles for someone with political and ideological and agenda ambitions, mm-hmm. to move from being on the outer circle to the inner circle, to having a committee, to having a better committee. Mm-hmm. So those are the vehicles for this. And
right.
You saw when Scott Psyche took over for Joe Suki and others, there's some movement around, but certainly also in the Senate, mm-hmm. When there's a turnover, the most prominent was Ways and Means.
Sure.
Right? So those who have a different agenda and their own personal ambition will always be kind of looking for opportunities to move up. That means that the leadership has to always be aware of the newbies coming up and how to give them their opportunity, you know, to make a difference, because everybody does want to make a difference. Even if it's self-serving, it's, mm-hmm. I want to be somebody.
You're a newly arrived legislator, be
yes.
it in the House or Senate, and what's your pathway to, you know, as you say, committee assignment, moving toward a committee chairmanship?
Yes, and who you get along with,
mm-hmm.
How much feistiness you want to display,
mm-hmm.
Vis-a-vis things that the majority are doing that you don't agree with. Whether or not you're going to adopt this notion of being a broker of people come to you and ask for your, or an advocate. So there are clear people who are advocates, partly because of their committees. Somebody like Chris Lee, for example, in the environment is an advocate. Others, like the new Vice Speaker Della Albalati, she's been kind of more of a broker in healthcare issues as mm-hmm. well as an advocate. Psyche is very much a broker. Sylvia Luke, who's chair of finance, is both a kind of advocate, but basically you've got to satisfy all these different ideas
mm-hmm.
and impulses and egos and desires of all the bills and money coming to you, right? So this is not necessarily a nefarious or evil thing. It is natural. That's for someone who come. When I went in, I was an environmental advocate and an educational advocate, and I definitely wanted to get to a place where I could make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
What is my pathway for that? And how much am I willing to tolerate before I, you know, my elbows flare out and I
yeah.
try to assert myself? And there's also personality. There are some people who are just so drawn to the cameras, like a moth to a flame, that they irritate their colleagues. You know? And that's all part of the mix. Human relationships. But what is really happening now is there are so many offices that are going to be vacated through ambition or terming out the city council. In the next two elections, 6 council members cannot run again.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This coming next year, 2 of them. And it's important to understand that a council district is bigger than a state senate district.
Mm-hmm.
The only district bigger is a congressional district. And now we have the opening of a congressional district with Colleen running for governor. Last time there were 7 or 8 candidates. that attempted to leave. Senators often, because they have a slightly bigger one. When Gilles Takuda says, I'm running for lieutenant governor, already the two representatives in her area, they're running for Senate, mm-hmm. right? Others are running for lieutenant governor. Two of the four mayors are running for lieutenant governor or governor or something like that. This is a very intoxicating lure for those who feel I've been around, I have something to offer, I can raise money, maybe I can go for it.
And I need to go to a better place on the board than I'm at now.
That's right. We don't have a big congressional delegation, so the mountain is very steep at the top. Not too many slots, but certainly council. If you want to play with the big boys. Five people on the city council control everything that happens on Oahu. That's an amazing thought, you know.
It does sound as if we're talking about a landscape where personal ambition might have more of an impact than ideology. And I'm thinking in particular of party platforms, where in Hawaii, where everybody's a Democrat, I wonder how much real influence the party has. You know, it's certainly not moving in lockstep.
Yes, the party has been in decline from Ariyoshi days when a gubernatorial campaign was not, it was about party, but it was about personality as well.
Right? Yeah.
You know? And so now, last year, with the sort of Bernie Hillary groups of the party,
right.
This created more of an ideological push on the part of the more progressive wing to say, hey, you should be following our ideological view, a little more liberal. Don't be a dino, a Democrat in name only. Mm-hmm. There's a tension with that going on. And you do have a number of young, not yet electeds, that are popping out, running, walking door to door, that sort of thing, coming out of various offices. They work for staff, you know. You're beginning to see that happen more and more in Hawaii. But the counterspin to that is the declining voter turnout is so pathetic that it tends to be the older regular voters who know older politicians just by name, and I met them at Long's and that sort of thing.
Not by party so much, but by personality.
By personality, and so therefore, anyone who's running with a Japanese kind of ethnic background,
right?
That group votes in larger percentages than others, mm-hmm. right? So it's harder for someone who's looking for independence, who often don't vote too much. It's important to understand between the age of 18 and 29 in the last election, 250,000 potential voters in Hawaii did not vote. And so therefore, if you're coming in with a millennial progressive point of view,
right?
Part of the problem is how do you get your fellow millennials?
You got to motivate those.
You've got to motivate them. Yep.
Well, it makes me wonder to what degree is party politics, party platforms, and the influence of party destined to further erode?
It has eroded. It has obviously eroded nationally. And it is eroded locally, right? It doesn't mean there aren't ideological camps, right? But it does mean that in Hawaii, the loyal opposition is very strong. It just doesn't happen to be the five Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's within the Democratic Party.
And it has been that even from when I went in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, it also is all these, if you place the players on the board today, you're going to have to change their placement 6 months from now, aren't you?
Absolutely. People are treading water, and because the primary election, the main election, is in August, if you're not already walking door to door, raising money, you're behind.
If you run for, say, a Senate office, how much money do you need to raise?
You're looking $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 more, depending on how well you are known. If you're very well known, maybe not that much. But if you're a newbie, you've got to get those resources, you've got to communicate, and you've got to walk door to door a lot.
a lot of factors other than ideology taking place, aren't there, Jim?
It's democracy.
It's democracy.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Jim Shaun, former lawmaker and longtime legislative observer, is the director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Culinary Institute of the Pacific, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Next time on Offshore.
I think we all like to feel that we're associated with something that's breaking new ground. And I think that America really does have this attitude of doing things no one else does or can do.
Why do astronomers feel a giant new telescope on top of Mauna Kea is so important? What will Hawaii and the scientific community stand to lose if the telescope isn't built? Tune in to Offshore, Saturdays at 4 p.m. on HPR.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, extending the reach of contemporary health care. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we thought about long extinct species that once dominated the islands, but soon went extinct after the first humans appeared. There were several species of ducks, and they were the island's principal herbivores for 3 million years. But they were fat, weighing up to 16 pounds, and flightless. They had evolved on islands without mammals or any other natural enemies for millennia, so they were doomed when people and their attendant animals showed up. They were unknown to Western science until the early 1980s, and with the discovery of fossil remains allowed scientists to reconstruct their story. We're looking for their Hawaiian name today, and its meaning is an evocative one, lost fowl. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable soap bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, this is Laura Thielen. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Good health should not be connected to how much money you have, but all too often it is. People with limited funds are far less likely to get the kind of preventive screenings that keep them healthy, and that's what drives nonprofits like Project Vision Hawaii, which is providing free vision and health screenings to underserved and low-income communities across the state of Hawaii. With her organization's 10th anniversary coming up, Annie Valentin is the founding executive director of Project Vision Hawaii, and she's with us in our studio. Hi, Annie. Thanks for coming in.
Aloha, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. What first made you aware of the need that you're working to fulfill?
Well, I grew up as six generations of women healers here in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And after college, I went to Nepal, where my great-grandparents had lived and were medical missionaries there.
Wow.
And found that working with the underserved was what drove me.
Mm-hmm.
When I came back, and I grew up here and had my mother is a very active community person and have always volunteered and worked in the community. But upon returning from my trip, I started working in healthcare and in surgery scheduling, and realized that how many uninsured individuals, migrants, and local people had issues with eye care issues, mm-hmm. that were not covered, or maybe they didn't know that they had issues with eye care. So just started digging deeper, and I was working at the Retina Institute of Hawaii at the time, and they had this program, Project Vision Hawaii, with a mobile unit. And we would go out into the different communities and started experiencing and talking to people about their eye care needs. Mm-hmm. And we would go to, you know, homeless shelters, senior homes, schools, and provide this resource. And it became very evident that there was an access to care, puka, with eye care issues and many, many other related issues. Because, you know, as you know, everything's connected.
Sure. Did you find a lot of need out there?
Oh, yeah. You know, as we've grown since 2007, we are a statewide program that meet the needs of different populations. As I mentioned, with kids in schools, we target Title I schools. Hawaii is one of eight states without a vision screening program. Many people don't know that. They just kind of assume, well, when I was growing up, I got a vision screening. And
right.
There was a program, actually. In 1989, it was mandated that vision screening be provided in schools. But in 1997, that program was defunded. So organizations like the Lions Club, the Rotarians, have been able to fill the gaps in some of the schools. But one of the things Project Vision Hawaii is doing is working boots on the ground to ensure that kids who need glasses get them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as daughter of a local ophthalmologist, I remember when I found out I needed glasses. I was in seventh grade, and I stopped being able to see the board. I went home and said, hey, I can't see the board. And she said, oh, you're fine, just like any good parent, you know, get back in the game, stop whining.
Yeah.
And I went back, and, you know, sure enough, she checked my eyes, and since did my LASIK surgery. That's, you know, my mom, Dr. Jenkins. And
mm-hmm.
and so if there's an access issue there, then you think about parents who have 2-3 jobs and, you know, don't have a medical degree
right.
in vision care. And if it's not being caught in the schools, how is it being caught? And these kids just, you know, think they're not smart, because what you see is what you see, and you don't necessarily know that it's not clear, right?
And especially when you're young, you can have a problem and not necessarily understand where that problem originates.
Exactly. And then with, you know, that was kind of one of the starting places and community events, and then working with people experiencing homelessness, we mm-hmm. were able to identify certain gaps, like with the people coming out of prison where there is no insurance coverage that can cover eye care. And so we've been able to work with people to help them get glasses so they can get jobs and so they can be productive members of society. And it's a simple adjustment
mm-hmm.
that can really transform someone's life.
Well, it's troubling whenever you see someone who has a medical condition where the only thing keeping them from getting rid of that is money, right? An entirely preventable medical condition that simply no one wants to pay for.
Definitely. Money is a big barrier, but also understanding and awareness.
Education.
And in Hawaii, you know, all of the state of Hawaii, and we are statewide, we go to Molokai, we go to Lanai every year.
Mm-hmm.
We have staff on Big Island, Maui, and Kauai. All of Hawaii is considered by the feds, HRSA,
HRSA, I'm sorry.
The Hawaii... rule Sorry, I'm having a brain moment.
Well, that's all right.
It's a federal acronym. But yeah, it's the federal kind of rule.
Oversees all.
Oversight, yeah. Defines all of the area of Hawaii as a medically underserved area, which is a MUA or a MOOP, medically underserved population. So, and we define our access issues as geographic. So, you know, obviously sometimes there's issues with transportation. There's not necessarily an eye doctor in Kau.
Sure.
Accessibility, that's the accessibility part. Affordability, which is the money part. And then appropriateness. So is medical care in the right language? Is it culturally presented in a way that will be, you know, received? So we try to address those barriers by working with community stakeholders. And that's...
Sounds as if it gets into a lot of areas that you might not even have anticipated having to deal with.
Definitely.
Especially the whole cultural appropriateness and some of the problems are familiar to residents of an island state where health care always becomes an issue with remote areas and specialized care, yeah.
Definitely. And we try to work with partners with the Native Hawaiian Health System and just local providers. So because we're a statewide program, we don't come in there saying, okay, this is how we deliver services. We say, okay, you know, you are the auntie on Molokai. You know your community better than us. Mm-hmm. Where should we go? What time should we be there? How can we try to generate awareness in your community to help provide services that will help people see?
What kind of wish list do you have for your organization going forward? You know, what would you like to see being able to expand if you could?
Well, there's lots of things like little things that are helpful, but there's also systematic things that are helpful, right? We're always looking for more supplies, glasses donations, and obviously funding is nice. Mm-hmm. We love good volunteers. We have volunteer opportunities for just about anyone, whether you're a medical person or not.
No need specialized knowledge.
No need. We work a lot with the Lions Clubs and Rotaries, so it's really about passion to want to serve people. But also from a systems level, we'd love to see a statewide vision screening program for kids again. Mm-hmm. It's something that we're getting closer and closer to, and we're working towards at the legislature currently.
You feel that there's some momentum toward that?
I do. I think there's a lot of awareness around it. You know, we at this point screen 10,000 kids a year, working in partnership already this year around 12,000 kids. Mm-hmm. But there's pretty inexpensive ways that we could, you know, ultimately save the state a lot of money by providing a simple resource like a pair of glasses to children.
Doesn't seem that far-fetched, does it, Annie? Thanks
very
much.
Well, we don't think so. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Annie Valentin is the founding executive director of Project Vision Hawaii, which celebrates its 10-year anniversary with an eyeball on Friday, September 22nd at the Wailea Country Club.
Aloha, I'm Melina Lilios, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The bill that passed the legislature's special session last week and now awaits the governor's signature is projected to raise approximately $2.4 billion over 13 years to bail out the rail project. It was born in a fractious environment and ended in an unexpected display of unity. Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton reviewed what it took to make the deal happen. He joins us with today's reality check. Hi, Stuart. Thanks for talking with us.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
It's a pretty interesting backstory to what emerged from the special session, isn't there?
There is, and I think one of the more interesting aspects of it is how it was really all about numbers when it came down to it. And fairly early on, the legislative leaders really decided that they would find one source of numbers. It was going to be the Department of Budget and Finance director, Wes Machida, that used his numbers and really try to craft something from those numbers. So at least they weren't disagreeing on the source of data that they were going to use.
Which had been a considerable problem previously, hadn't it?
Well, one of the issues, again, is figuring out what numbers are we going to use. And so another aspect of it was they looked at HART's data. The cost of the project was $8.165 billion total, not counting financing costs. Again, the financing costs could add hundreds of millions of more dollars depending on the source. Mm-hmm. But that was one thing that they did, and that really helped along the way.
Well, the unity that emerged, or the perception of unity that emerged, was a surprise even to some of those who unified, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And one of the things to remember or to bear in mind is that this was a compromise. And I spoke to one of the members this morning who said, you know, remember, this was a compromise. Nobody was completely happy with this.
Yeah.
But I think in the end, they were able to come together. And again, the people we're talking about on the Senate side, it was the Senate president. The new Ways and Means Chairman, Donovan Dela Cruz. On the House side, we had the Speaker of the House, Scott Psyche, the Finance Committee Chair, Sylvia Luke, and the Transportation Committee Chair, Henry Aquino. And those five really were able to come together and craft a deal, partly because of the mayor, Kurt Caldwell. He really came out after this group had put together a plan. The mayor came out and said, we need more money. This all played out last week, and the group pretty much stood steadfast. They also had support from the U.S. Senator Brian Schatz, the Congressional Representative Colleen Hanabusa, and so there was a big group of people who were saying, no, this is the bill, these numbers work, this is the deal, and they were able to push it through.
What if Caldwell's right and it isn't enough money?
That's a really good question. The one thought is that the FTA, Federal Transit Administration, will say this isn't enough. They'll reject the plan, and it could spell the end of the rail project. Another is that the tax revenue won't match projections, and that's going to create a problem. The other issue to look for in the future, though, is what about operations and maintenance? If those numbers fall short, and that's really going to be on the city and county and HART to put together, it might end up resulting in the need for a property tax increase here in Honolulu. So that's something to look out for in the future.
Oahu residents will be thrilled to hear that, Stuart, right? I think we're not entirely done with this story. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton. It's the final hurdle for a performing artist, stage fright, that paralyzing anxiety that can sabotage a performance, hijack all the years spent perfecting a craft, and turn what should be a career milestone into a misery. Filmmaker John Beter has woven his own experience of performance anxiety into a documentary film that looks at stage fright through the eyes of professional classical musicians, people whose livelihood depends on overcoming their fears. John's with us in our studio. Hi, John. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Was one of the initial stimuli for you making the film your own experience?
Absolutely. I have an undergraduate degree in percussion performance and can remember very vividly the times when my hands would shake, mm-hmm. When my heart would start to race right before a performance or an audition. And that was a big part of wanting to make this, is the fact that I unfortunately didn't really have any opportunity to speak about that with people when I was going through it all.
Most people who go into an audition take a piece that they have rehearsed so many times that you reach the point in your practice sessions of saying, I got this, right? I could play this thing by heart. It's inside me. And then the fear can just cancel all that skill, throw it right out the window, can't it?
Absolutely. Part of the problem is that so many musicians spend the majority of their time in a practice room, which makes sense, to hone the skills.
Have to, right? The woodshed.
Exactly. But they don't get as much experience actually performing. So the process of performing is very different from practicing. You don't stop in the middle of a performance.
Right.
You don't, analyze as you're going through.
Yeah.
So suddenly, sometimes people are faced with these performances where these feelings, their adrenaline is going, which isn't normally going in the mm-hmm. practice room, and it throws off the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we talk about in the film is making sure students, young students, and those in university and conservatories have opportunities to perform as well as practice, making it not so much of a strange place, the stage, but more of a place where you go to express yourself, and that's comfortable, not foreign and strange.
Sort of a place to have a low impact experience.
Exactly.
Sense.
Exactly. Yeah. I think growing up and even in college, I had very few experiences auditioning. And mm-hmm. so when they would happen, there's no surprise there that I would be nervous and feel kind of, uncomfortable
sure.
in those situations.
You're thrown into, in a practice room, you've got everything right where you want it. You got your music stand, your metronome, your little glass of, I always have a glass of iced tea
mm-hmm.
at hand. And I've done, in my own practice room, I've done a lot to make that a comfortable environment. The very opposite of what an audition environment is going to be.
Absolutely. And what we've found is that some musicians, realizing this, have done a really great job of making themselves very uncomfortable to practice that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So from some of our cast members, we heard that they would do things like running up and down stairs and then performing their pieces. Mm-hmm. Or gathering folks just walking by to come and listen to them play to give that kind of sense of a performance rather than a practice room.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds as if the different elements that contribute to performance anxiety can be sort of isolated and once isolated, understood. Changing the physical environment, physical things like reducing your heart rate.
Yeah, I think what's helped me as far as addressing anxiety, not just in performance but in daily life, is acknowledging it, is knowing, oh, I feel adrenaline right now. My hands feel sweaty. Why is that? Why is that happening? And taking that kind of 2 seconds or sometimes more to understand why it's happening is incredibly powerful, rather than just feeling like a victim of this adrenaline of why is this happening, mm-hmm. what's going on. I can start to understand it. And I think that's something really important for people is to be able to stop and kind of take a moment to understand, well, why would I be nervous? Why would my hands be shaking right now? And then go from there and start to understand it more. It's a lot more healthy than just going, I'm freaking out and I don't know why.
Sure. Well, I think it's also reassuring when you find that well-known artists, successful artists who go all over the world, still experience that, because they do, don't they?
They do. We actually ran a survey of professional orchestral musicians in the U.S., and we found that 98% of the respondents had at one time or another experienced performance anxiety. Mm-hmm. I presented that to some orchestral musicians, and a guy from the Chicago Symphony came up to me and said, just so you know, I think 2% of people are liars.
I guessed you were going to tell me that, right?
Yeah. So it's definitely something we all experience, but have trouble speaking about.
Well, now that we've sort of gotten it out in the open, you have to wonder, you know, if it's a pretty miserable experience to be terrified, especially when there are a bunch of people out there looking at you. So why do it?
You know, I think a lot of us, when we're young, we get into music because it's an enjoyable experience. Mm-hmm. And then you want to get better at it. You want more opportunities. So you practice and develop a good ear to kind of understand how you're progressing. And sometimes, and this is something we've talked about with a lot of our cast, people do go through this kind of question of, well, why do I do this if it feels so terrible? And for some folks, feeling nervous is very similar to feeling excited.
Yeah.
You know, those sensations that you're feeling, and being able to mentally turn that nervousness into excitement allows them to find that passion again and realize, oh, wait, no, I love doing this. That energy, it can help me. That energy can actually make this a better performance and make me more engaged and bring back those feelings of joy that I had.
Well, just speaking personally, that was my experience. That's been my experience of it. And I've certainly asked a lot of people in the performing arts on this show, how do you deal with it? And I get variations of the same answer, and that would be my answer as well. It's a quantum of energy to be employed as I see fit, if I can get a handle on it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, adrenaline is there for a reason. It can be very powerful. It can help us get through things. It can help us be, you know, think faster. You know, you can sometimes be more hyper aware of
what's
happening.
That's what it's for.
Exactly. And so understanding that it's a tool, that it's something there to help us, just in and of itself can be powerful. So I think part of, you know, addressing this is understanding that it's there for a reason, mm-hmm. that it can be used, and it doesn't have to be something that you force back down or try to conceal or try to hold within. It can be something that can be used and released in a positive way.
Are you going to return to the performing life?
You know, I get asked.
You've got
that
a camera
a lot.
To hide behind, now, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'd love to get back into music and wonder what it would be like now going back into those performance situations.
I have to think, John, you would go into it with some little more understanding, quite a bit more understanding.
Absolutely. You know, it would be impossible for me to not use some of these things that we've learned about in my own practice. And honestly, I do it when we do interviews, when I speak in front of people, I use those exact same methods to address my own anxiety that musicians are using when they go on stage.
Well, it's not a skill that's peculiar to performing artists. It's a life skill.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's just kind of how to handle, right?
Exactly. You know, anxiety is not restricted to the stage. It's something that we feel in daily life.
If only, right?
Yeah.
John, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
John Reeder is the producer and director of Composed, a film about performance anxiety that will be shown this evening at Punahou School's Dillingham Hall. The screening is free and open to the public.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
In today's backyard quiz, scientists in the early 1980s discovered a lost species of flightless birds that once thrived on most of the archipelago's principal islands. They could weigh 16 to 18 pounds when full grown, and centuries of predator-free evolution had weakened their defenses, so they didn't last long after human contact. But for 3 million years earlier, they were the island's principal herbivore. They had hard, tooth-like projections on their bills that allowed them to chew through vegetation. Scientists who've reconstructed their story through fossil evidence figure they lost their ability to fly sometime before Hawaii Island emerged from the sea. That's the only major island where they were not found. It's no fun being fat, flightless, and edible when predators come around, and today the Moa Nalo are just a memory. Nobody got that today, but that was today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Many of us get to a point where we wish we could start our lives all over. Some of us get to a place where we have to. In the stage musical The Spitfire Grill, a young woman fresh out of prison comes to a Wisconsin town to discard old baggage and find new opportunities, finding reasons to hope in some unexpected places. The show is coming to the University of Hawaii's Kennedy Theater, and two of its cast members, Joran Young and Rachel Ueno, are with us in our studio. Hi, Joran. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start, Joran, with your character, because you're the principal character. And what's your story? You were in prison for 5 years. Now you're looking to rebuild your life, right?
Yes. My character's name is Percy Talbot, and she is an interesting character where she comes into this small town, Gilead, and not knowing, you know, what to do there or no one there. She's just kind of to herself, mm-hmm. but she's just there to start a new life. After being in prison for 5 years, she, you know, has things that she wants to leave behind and wants to race to another, I don't know, destination to call home, mm-hmm. maybe, and find a new home for herself.
And Rachel, this town, Gilead, Wisconsin, a fictitious yes. town, is your home, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And what's your attitude toward your home?
sorry. So it's the town was built around this quarry, and it closed recently. On top of that, the highway that came through recently went through a completely different town.
Oh,
so
boy.
We have kind of dwindled. Mm-hmm. There's just no prospects for anyone. There is only one place to eat in town, which happens to be where we end up working. But it's home. It is where I grew up, and it's where my husband believes his place is.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to take care of his aunt Hannah, who runs the grill, and trying to take care of the town and make it a better place. He just wants it to be the way that it was and is having a hard time dealing with the fact that he can't seem to make it work.
What's your relationship to Joran's character?
At the start of it, it's just that she's this new, fresh energy, something potentially good that I've only lived here and I've not been outside of the town. So having something new, like somebody who I can talk to and maybe create a bond with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that my character, Shelby, is also this very nurturing person,
mm-hmm.
and sees something that she wants to take care of, like someone that she can help in some way.
Joran, having been in prison for 5 years,
mm-hmm.
has got some pretty hard edges, doesn't she?
Yes.
How do you manifest those in your acting? How does that emerge?
Well, it takes a lot of practice. No, but there's just moments in the scenes in the play where I just like get angry and I burst out, and I take it on Shelby's character, and I take it on my this other guy named Joe in the in the play, where I just like burst out at him, and I tend to just like get so angry. And I feel like that also has something to do with how I was in prison, where, you know, like you don't find people that are always like so nice and nurturing, you know, like you don't, or you're not used to this kind of behavior. Like people are trying to,
to fight for survival, right?
Yes, it was. And then just being free is not, you know, exactly being free for me. Like I'm still used to like the specific way I've always been for 5 years.
Yeah. You two have a song that you perform together.
Yes.
In the show. What are the circumstances when this song is about to be sung?
So I've, at this point, I have told Percy about how Hannah, who owns the grill, she's trying to get rid of it. And she's been trying to get rid of it for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And Percy comes up with this great idea. Well, why don't we just do a contest and people can write in for a chance to win the Spitfire. Like everybody send in $100, write an essay about why you want to win. And whoever wins, they can have it. And then Hannah can go on with her life.
Right, right.
And so after we convince Hannah that this is a potentially good idea, it's our job now to do like a press release.
Uh-huh.
So we have to figure out, okay, how can we make this place sound so awesome that everybody's going to want to send in their $100?
So this is the song that's going to make us feel that way?
It's us figuring out how to say these things. And for Percy, she came in, the whole reason that she came to this town, she had this picture of,
Found a picture back in prison saying autumn colors along Copper Creek near Gilead, Wisconsin. And from then on, I was just like, this is my new town. This is my hope. Like, after I get out of prison, this is where I'm going to go. Huh? So for Shelby, living there all her life, that's like, you know, something she's used to. She's used to Gilead. But for me, that's like my new, like, adventure. Like, this is something, from my eyes, a new perspective of
all the trees, you know, and
all
everything.
The trees and how Gilead is.
Well, let's hear that song.
Okay. It's a bit long, so
we'll just do an excerpt.
I'll start
waving my arms if it.
Okay, awesome. Okay, and we don't have any music, but it's fine. The morning when the hickories turn golden,
when the hickories turn
and
gold,
sunlight burns the maples red as fire,
red as fire. The meadow glows, the riverbank is blazing. Like paradise, come down to lift you higher. Then you look out from your front porch to see the sun go down. Another night has fallen on the streets of your hometown. And all at once you understand that you are here to stay. With roots so deep into the earth, they'll never pull away. In a town where you are from, then the colors of paradise come, and the colors of paradise come, the colors of paradise come to you, and the colors of paradise come, and the colors of paradise come, and the colors of paradise come. Colors of paradise come.
Hey, that was really impressive.
It's different.
Some tricky harmonies and some tricky phrasing in there.
Yeah.
Did you take you a long time to?
We had about a week to just hammer everything out.
Yeah, yeah.
And since then, it's been a lot of we have a really wonderful music director, Ike Webster. He recently worked on All Shook Up at Diamond Head. I think he got a Poikella for that. But he's a fantastic vocal coach.
He
really understands the mechanics of vocal work. Mm-hmm. And so I really feel that I'm going to come out of this process a better singer. I have not had a lot of formal training. Mm-hmm. So this is great. And he also takes some liberties with, you know what? I don't like the harmony. Let's do this instead. I think this will be better.
Do what works, right?
Yeah.
Thanks to both of you for talking with us. I'm really looking forward to seeing this show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jorn Young plays Percy and Rachel Ueno plays Shelby in UH Manoa's Department of Theater and Dance production of the musical The Spitfire Grill, which will be performed at Kennedy Theater the weekends of September 15th and 22nd.
I hear she appeared on the street last night, right at the midnight bell.
I think you read too many of the tabloids that you sell.
I hear people talk all over town, I thought that you should know.
Nice to see you're so concerned, now take a seat or go.
Say what you want, say what you will, something's cooking on the Spitfire Grill.
Now, I had a boyfriend. He was going for a Cat Stevens look, but it doesn't really work when you have a retainer. He also had a tendency to refer to me as m'lady.
Join us next time for more True Stories Told Live. This week, camp, cars, roaches, and the Kremlin on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at 2 p.m., right after This American Life.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, dissecting the ins and outs of Hawaii's tax structure with the Tax Foundation of Hawaii's Tom Yamachika, and promoting early childhood literacy in Hawaii's Title I schools with skating star Christy Yamaguchi. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line and leave your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandergoed. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.